This is Audible.
More Than Two, A Practical Guide to Ethical Polyamory. Written by Franklin Vo and Eve Rickard. Narrated by Craig Beck. Forward by Janet W. Hardy, co-author of The Ethical Slut. It was around 20 years ago that my co-author, Dossie Easton, and I spoke to a room full of Mensa members about what was then generally called S&M. We'd already written and published the bottoming book and the topping book and taught a bunch of workshops and done a bunch of public scenes, so we were used to being outrageous in front of audiences. We had fun. But afterward, a friend told me about a conversation she'd overheard. "Did you hear about that S&M presentation this afternoon?" she mimicked in a voice high-pitched with shock. "There's these two women giving it, and they're talking about stuff they'd done together, and one of their boyfriends is right in the room." That's how unaware the world was of polyamory and other monogamy alternatives back then. And that's when we knew we needed to write a book about poly. The first edition of The Ethical Slut was published in 1997, and we were both pretty startled by the virulent reaction it got. Far more virulent, much to our surprise, than we'd gotten for our BDSM titles. As we made the circuit of morning drive radio shows and local access cable television, we heard from the woman who said she'd go upside his head with a frying pan if her husband ever dared propose such a thing. Another woman told us we were the cause of the decline of Western civilization and that our book should be banned and we should be tied up and whipped. We were able to restrain our giggles until the commercial break. When you're writing in a context like that, most of your job has to do with gently prying open your reader's mind, casting a bit of light on unexamined prejudices, and making space for new ways of thinking. Even if we'd wanted to suggest some practical guidelines for how to make poly relationships work better, we had a relatively small database of experience and wisdom to work from. Basically, our own lives, and those of our circle of queerish, kinkyish, San Franciscoish friends, whose needs and circumstances were quite different from those of the average American reader. So we stuck, for the most part, to first principles and left the nuts and bolts for other writers. We had no idea, way back then, that we, in our little book, were about to climb a gigantic wave of interest in polyamorous lifestyles. Slut has outsold all our other books put together by a handy margin. It went on, a decade and a half later, into a larger, more slickly published edition from a major publisher, with exercises and practical information in addition to the basic principles. But we're still only two writers, with our own backgrounds and prejudices. We're proud to have helped create a world, the world of polyamory, that's big enough and various enough to need different opinions, ideas, and approaches from ours. I've traveled the world teaching ethical slut workshops. When I ask my attendees about the biggest problem they've encountered doing polyamory, they've usually responded by naming something to do with logistics, time, space, attention, or something to do with jealousy. And these are indeed thorny issues. But I'd argue that they're really symptoms of a deeper problem. Imagine that you're a monogamous person having the kinds of relationship problems that monogamous people have. Jealousy. Yes, they feel it too. Boredom, bed death, whatever. What do you do? You call a therapist. You ask your friends. You watch Dr. Phil. You go to the bookstore and pick up one of the dozens of titles aimed at teaching monogamous people how to be better at monogamy. But if you're a poly person, where do poly people go to get our answers? If we're lucky, we may live in a major city and be internet savvy and know the word polyamory, so we know what term to search on and have life circumstances that enable us to go to a poly munch or meetup. For the rest of the world, though, there are websites and books, and not nearly enough of either. Many people, sad to say, attempt polyamory without knowing anyone who has done it successfully and is willing to talk about it in public. Many have little or no access to the small but growing body of wisdom that successful polyamorists have accumulated and shared, which is why it's past time for More Than Two. I've e-known, if that's the word for someone you've known on the internet but have never met, Franklin Vo for a long time now. His co-author, Eve, is new to me. They are both experienced and articulate polyamorists. Franklin's poly website, zeromag.com, now morethan2.com, dates back to 1997, the same year the first edition of Slut was published. I'm pleased to say that I disagree with Franklin and Eve on a few points. If you want to know which, you'll have to read both our books. But honestly, I'd be worried if I didn't. There are as many ways to do poly as there are people doing it. And beyond the basics of disclosure and consent, there's no right or wrong way. There are only things that have worked for some people and other things that haven't worked for others. Monogamous people get to decide whether to listen to advice from Dr. Phil or Dr. Laura or any other relationship doctors that fill our radio waves and TV screens. Poly people should have the same opportunities to listen to different advice and make their own choices. Different authors have different styles. Dossie and I have been described as big sisters, if your big sister is a slutty, kinky, aging hippie. Franklin and Eve are more like wise neighbors. Think of the guy on the other side of the fence on Home Improvement, calm and wise and funny. Dossie and I write primarily about the sexual aspects of poly. Franklin and Eve are more interested in the day-to-day living part. Dossie and I like to indulge ourselves, just a little, in high-flown realms of abstraction and idealism. Franklin and Eve like to keep their feet on the ground. You'll probably find yourself relating more to one style than the other, and that's just exactly the way it should be. The more people who open their minds to the infinite possibilities of poly, the more space there will be for new books. Can polyamory for dummies be far in the future? New opinions, specialized publications, personal gatherings, and more. Someday, perhaps there will be as many resources and role models for poly people as there are today for monogamists. I'd like to live in a world where my grandchildren-to-be can watch the Bill and Joan and Pat show as matter-of-factly as I watch the Brady Bunch. Well, my great-grandchildren anyway. And books like More Than Two are one of the ways that will happen. I hope you enjoy reading it as much as I did. Janet W. Hardy. Introduction. Will is married to Rachel. They own a beautiful house. Will, not his real name, is a successful businessman who runs a prosperous company. Every day, he comes home to Rachel and to her boyfriend Arnold, who also shares their home. Will and Arnold are good friends who often spend time together. The three of them plan vacations and go hiking together. Sometimes Arnold's girlfriend, Layla, joins them. Santiago and Winona are engaged. They're both dating another woman, Helen. Santiago and Winona have been together for more than 6 years. He started dating Helen 3 years ago, and about a year after that, Helen and Winona started dating each other. Santiago and Winona live together. Helen lives nearby. Eliza likes her independence. She doesn't fancy being tied down in a conventional relationship. She lives on her own, and she prefers it that way. She's been dating Kyle for about 5 years, and they're madly in love. Kyle is a long-distance partner. He lives in another state with his girlfriend Melody. When Eliza visits Kyle, she stays with them both. Eliza is also dating Stacy, who lives nearby with her husband Seth. Eliza and Stacy have been dating for 4 years. Seth and Eliza are friends, though they aren't romantic partners. We know all of these people. Yes, it is possible to live this way. Hundreds of thousands of people are doing it right now. It's called polyamory, which literally means many loves. The crucial point, it's done with the full knowledge and consent of everyone who's affected. Polyamorous relationships can be joyous, brimming with laughter and love, but they rarely just happen. They take work, and they require trust, communication, and kindness. It's easier to build healthy, vibrant poly relationships and avoid disaster when you can see others doing it and learn from them. This is easier now than it used to be. In the past 30 years, the growing worldwide community of polyamorous people has built a treasure vault of hard-won wisdom. Much of it has been achieved at a bitter price, through many, many people's trials, errors, crashes, and hard-won insights. We know far more than we did a generation ago about what is likely to work, and why, and how, and also what is a consistent track record of failure. The authors of this book have been through a combined 40 years of poly life. In addition to living it daily, we have observed literally thousands of poly relationships. For 20 years, Franklin has run probably the most linked to polyamory information site on the web. Franklin started living polyamorously in the early 1980s, long before people were using the word. He had no language for what he felt. No community support, no role models, no one to talk to or learn from. He had to find his own way, and so he got to make all the mistakes on his own. That included marrying a monogamous woman and living for nearly 2 decades in a hierarchical, veto-based relationship that was never really happy for anyone. In 1997, the same year The Ethical Slut was published, he launched a website, then at zeromag.com, now morethan2.com, filled with the introductory polyamory resources. His goal was to provide all the information that he'd wished he'd had when he first started out. The website grew and changed, transforming over the years along with Franklin's relationships and his thinking about polyamory. It is now one of the first Google hits for polyamory. Over the years, he's received thousands of emails from people thanking him for helping or even saving their relationships. His work is sometimes controversial, but the fact is, it helps people. Eve first learned about polyamory when she was 12 from a Sunday school teacher who challenged her assumptions about monogamous relationships and introduced her to the concepts of primary and secondary partners. In high school, her social group flirted with polyamorous ideas and practices, but didn't have a framework for exploring them under that name. After high school, Eve's own relationships were monogamous, though she had friends who were poly. In her 30s, she and her husband-to-be opened their monogamous relationship. She has embraced polyamory since 2008. We tell our personal stories throughout this book. We're not experts on polyamory. We believe there are no experts. Polyamory is still too new for that. We wrote this book because we spent a lot of time exploring this nearly trackless space. And along the way, we've made plenty of mistakes we'd like to help you avoid. If what you find here serves you, use it. If it doesn't, that's okay too. Look at some of the other wonderful resources listed in the back of this book to find what meets your needs. Polyjargon. As polyamory has grown as a relationship model, it has developed its own vocabulary. Folks in poly relationships will talk about compassion, a feeling of joy at the happiness of a new partner in a new relationship, a new relationship energy, or NRE, the giddy honeymoon phase of a newfound love. You might hear someone talk about wibbles or minor twinges of jealousy. An OSO is a person's other significant other. All this lingo can create a certain amount of confusion. After all, the idea of non-monogamous relationships isn't new. People have been stepping out, swapping wives, and generally fooling around since the dawn of time. So why all these new words? New terminology arises where old terminology doesn't fit. These terms evolved to give polyamorous people a way to discuss the joys, challenges, and situations they encounter that might not have direct corollaries in monogamy or in the most common forms of non-monogamy, which aren't polyamorous. The new jargon is a way to talk about what polyamory is: ethical, open, consensual, long-term, romantic relationships, without using the language of cheating or of swinging, casual wife-swapping, and other forms of traditional non-monogamy. We have tried to be careful not to overload this book with jargon, but if you get lost, there is a glossary in the back of the paperback and digital versions of the book. Themes in this book. As you read this book, you will see several ideas we return to again and again. We have observed that happy, strong relationships of any kind have certain things in common, and we talk about them many times. The first idea is trust. Many problems in any relationship, but especially in poly relationships, come down to how much do I trust my partner. Having such trust is often more difficult than it sounds, because internal emotions such as insecurity or low self-esteem can affect how much confidence we place in a partner's love for us. The second theme is courage. We suggest many approaches to relationship that require confronting socially imposed norms and our own fears, and that takes courage. When many people think of courage, they think of a firefighter charging into a burning building, or a person facing down a hungry leopard. Extraordinary acts of bravery in the face of danger. The kind of courage we mean is more personal. Ordinary things. Talking about our feelings, even when we're afraid. Giving a partner the freedom to explore new relationships, even when we fear being abandoned. Challenging ourselves to step outside our comfort zones, even when we aren't sure there will be someone there to catch us. The third theme is abundance. Looked at one way, polyamory might seem hopeless, We're seeking people who also want this unconventional way of life, which limits our potential dating pool, who have a compatible sexual orientation and gender identity, which narrows it further, who are available for new romantic connections, which narrows it still more, whose style of poly is compatible with ours, who we have a chemistry with. How can we expect to find anyone? Looked at another way, we share this world with more than 7 billion other people. So even 10% of 10% of 10% of 10% is over 700,000 potential partners. Surely an embarrassment of riches. How we think about potential relationships, whether we view them as scarce or abundant, will make a huge difference in our romantic lives. The fourth idea is ethics. We strongly believe there are ethical and unethical ways to treat other people, and we talk about them throughout this book. Treating people with compassion, integrity, and respect, no matter what role they play in our lives, is something we believe to be of paramount importance in happy, healthy relationships. The last theme we often return to is empowerment. We believe that relationships work best when all the people involved feel empowered to help shape and guide their relationships, to advocate for their needs, and to feel they have a hand in the outcomes. Polyamory, like any worthwhile endeavor, is a journey. We hope to give you some signposts to help you along the way, but nobody can make the journey for you. It's up to you to navigate your way towards happy, ethical, compassionate relationships. Part 1. What is polyamory? Starting the journey. The most successful people in life recognize that in life they create their own love. They manufacture their own meaning. They generate their own motivation. Neil deGrasse Tyson. It's a story as old as time. Boy meets girl. Or perhaps boy meets boy, or girl meets girl. They date, they fall in love. They pledge sexual and emotional fidelity, start a family, and settle down to live happily ever after. The end. But the story often proves to be a fairy tale. All too often it continues on into misery, breakdown, separation, divorce. Boy meets new girl, lather, rinse, repeat. In one common variant, boy meets girl, they settle down, one of them meets someone new, things get messy, dishes are thrown, hearts are broken. Or perhaps you've heard this version, girl meets two boys, or vice versa, a tragic choice must be made, someone is left heartbroken, and everybody is left wondering what might have been. We propose that there is a different way to write this story. Boy meets girl. They fall in love. Girl meets another boy. They fall in love. Girl and boy meet another boy. Girl meets girl. Girl meets boy. And they all live happily ever after. The word polyamory was coined in the early 1990s from the Greek poly, meaning many, and the Latin amor, meaning love. It means having multiple loving, often committed relationships at the same time by mutual agreement, with honesty and clarity. We know what you're thinking. Who does the laundry? But we'll get to that in a bit. Polyamory isn't about sneaking off and getting some action on the sly when your girlfriend is out of town. Nor is it about dating three people and keeping everyone in the dark. It's not about joining a religious cult and marrying a dozen teenage girls or having recreational sex while maintaining only one real relationship. Or going to parties where you drop your keys in a hat. Poly relationships come in an astounding variety of shapes, sizes, and flavors, just like the human heart. There are the V relationships, where one person has two partners who aren't romantically involved with each other. Triad relationships, where three are mutually involved. And quad relationships of four people who may or may not all be romantically involved with one another. A relationship might be polyfidelitous, which means the people agree not to pursue additional partners, or it may be open to members starting new relationships. A poly person might have one or more primary partners and one or more secondary partners, or recognize no rankings. They might have a group marriage, sharing finances, a home, and maybe children as a single family. Some people imagine that polyamory involves a fear of commitment. The truth is, commitment in polyamory doesn't mean commitment to sexual exclusivity. Instead, it means commitment to a romantic relationship, with everything that goes along with that. Commitment to being there when your partner needs you, to investing in their happiness, to building a life with them, to creating happy and healthy relationships that meets everyone's needs, and to supporting one another when life gets hard. Unfortunately, society has taught us to view commitment only through the lens of sexual exclusivity. This diminishes all the other important ways that we commit to one another. People who can't commit to one person sure as hell can't commit to more than one. Polyamory isn't the same thing as polygamy, which means having multiple spouses, most often in the form of polygyny or multiple wives, sometimes in the form of polyandry or multiple husbands. It's not about keeping a harem, though we do know of some of you there in the back row were kind of hoping we'd go that way. It's not the same as swinging, though some poly people also swing, as we discuss in chapter 17 on opening from a couple. And finally, it's not about rampant promiscuity. Polyamorous relationships are relationships with good times, bad times, problem solving, communication, and yes, laundry. Down with the fairy tale. The prelude to lifelong monogamy echoes through our culture in fairy tales we all hear. A beautiful, charming young woman toils alone in an unhappy life, friendless, and beset on all sides. She endures hardships and trauma until one day along comes her handsome prince, who swoops down and lifts her into his arms. They fall in love, the chorus swells, the curtain closes. Stories like this resonate with us because they offer a comforting view of relationships. True love conquers all. Everyone has a soulmate, just waiting to be found. Once we've found our soulmate, we will live happily ever after. Love is all you need. There's no need to work hard at understanding yourself or your needs. No need to keep working on happiness once you've found it. Forget the fairy tale. Happily ever after is a myth. Because people, unlike characters in fairy tales, are not static. We live, we grow, we change. Happy, healthy, romantic lives require not just continual reinvestment, but constant awareness of the changes in our partners, our situations, and ourselves. Our partners do not owe us a guarantee that they will never change, nor do we owe anyone such a guarantee. And as we change, so do the things that make us happy. Polyamory can feel threatening because it upsets our fairy tale assumption that the right partner will keep us safe from change. Polyamory introduces the prospect of chaos and uncertainty into what's supposed to be a straightforward progression to bliss. But a healthy relationship must first of all be resilient, able to respond to the changes and complexity that life brings. Nor is happiness actually a state of being. It is a process, a side effect of doing other things. The fairy tale tells us that with the right partner, happiness just happens. But happiness is something we recreate every day, and it comes more from our outlook than from the things around us. The relationship fairy tale carries other hidden falsehoods. For instance, it promises that one person will always be able to meet our needs. The idea that polyamory addresses this situation has its own problems, as we talk about in Chapter 4. But it's still unreasonable to expect one person to be everything. If we accept the fairy tale, we may feel shaky and insecure whenever reality doesn't live up to our expectations. We may imagine that if we are attracted to someone else, something is wrong. Actor Johnny Depp, whose ongoing relationship turmoil is the stuff of tabloid legend, famously remarked, "If you love two people at the same time, choose the second, because if you really loved the first one, you wouldn't have fallen for the second." Cue poly eye roll. On the other hand, if our one true love is attracted to someone else, we may feel like a failure. After all, if we do everything we're supposed to do, then we should be enough, right? And if a partner loves someone else, that means our love isn't good enough, right? The idea of the one, the love of your life, is seductive. In reality, it's perfectly possible to have more than one love of your life. The two of us know many people who do, and each of us has several loves of our lives, and we're not even romantically involved with all of them. Even though all of our loves have other loves, we feel secure, because we have many people who will always be there for us. Why be poly? The best way to understand why someone might be polyamorous is to ask, what do people get out of relationships in the first place? Romance is a fiddly business, even in the best of circumstances. Why not just give it all a miss and be done with it? A quick answer might be, we are happier when we're in relationships than when we're not. Humans are social animals. We do better when we share our lives intimately with others. We're built for it. As complicated and as messy and unpredictable as romance is, its rewards are fantastic. Indeed, most of us feel driven to seek out people who see us for what we are, who share themselves with us, who love us. For many people, establishing a romantic relationship switches off this drive. The task is done. The race is won. There's no need to find new partners. But for some, being in a relationship doesn't flip off that switch. We remain open to the idea of new connections and more love. We engage in multiple romantic relationships and love others who do the same, because doing so enriches the lives of everyone involved. Loving more than one person at the same time is not an escape from intimacy. It is an enthusiastic embrace of intimacy. Polyamorous relationships have practical benefits. More adults in a family often provides greater financial freedom and security. Some polyfolk combine living spaces, incomes, and expenses, which increases everyone's financial flexibility. Even polypeople who don't cohabit or share expenses gain many things from mutual support among multiple partners. If you're having a bad day, there are more people to comfort and help you. If you're having a problem, you get more perspectives. You have more of everything you get from romantic relationships. More companionship, more advice, more joy, more love. Being poly can also be fantastic for your sex life. Sex is a learned skill, and the human sexual horizon is vast. Whatever your tastes, however ingenious your imagination, the range of sexual experience is so great that someone, somewhere, is doing something you'd love to do that would never occur to you. Each time you invite another lover into your life, you have the opportunity to learn things that you might never otherwise have learned. Often, things you can bring into your existing relationships. Nobody is so creative that she has nothing to learn from someone else. Conversely, there is a community saying, some people go into poly to have more sex, some go into poly to have less sex. A monogamous couple with a mismatched sex drives has a major problem. Constant frustration on one side and constant unwanted demands on the other kill marriages routinely. But when the couple is part of a larger network of lovers, everyone can more easily find their own level, and the pressure is off. Are you polyamorous? For some of us, whether we're polyamorous or monogamous is obvious. For others, it isn't. Many poly people feel it's an intrinsic part of who they are, like hair color or sexual orientation. A person who feels inherently non-monogamous can identify as poly, even if she has only one relationship, or none. Others embrace polyamory because they see it as inherently more honest than monogamy, which often requires denying attractions to other people. Still, other folks see polyamory as a way to shed the assumptions about property and control that have long gone hand in hand with monogamy. Deciding whether poly is a good fit requires not only deciding whether you're non-monogamous, but also whether the things you want from life and the personal ethics you bring to the world align well with having multiple honest romantic relationships. For instance, a desire for sexual variety without romantic attachments might point to swinging as a better fit. A desire for multiple romantic relationships without openness or transparency might mean some self-work is in order. Polyamory is not right for everyone. Polyamory is not the next wave in human evolution, nor is it more enlightened, more spiritual, more progressive, or more advanced than monogamy. Polyamorous people are not automatically less jealous, more compassionate, or better at communicating than monogamists. We believe relationships that are deliberately, intentionally constructed are more satisfying and more likely to lead to happiness than relationships whose shape is determined by default social expectations. It is absolutely possible for a monogamous relationship to be built by careful, deliberate choice. Many people are content in monogamous relationships, and that's fine. Monogamy doesn't necessarily mean simply following a social norm. If you decide that polyamory is not a good fit for your life, that's okay. Don't do it or let anyone push you into it. It's useful to think of polyamory as an outgrowth of a certain set of relationship ideas. Rather than asking, "Am I polyamorous?" you could ask yourself, "Are the tools and ideas of polyamory useful to me?" Even if you don't desire multiple relationships, the things we talk about in this book may be valuable to you. Misconceptions about polyamory. At this point, some of you may still be thinking, "Woohoo! Endless orgies!" And others of you are likely thinking, "What a load of horse manure. This is just a fancy way of saying your partner lets you cheat." For anyone who imagines that being poly means sleeping with whomever you like, whenever you like, without having to consider others' feelings, we have some bad news for you. A polyamorous relationship does not mean that anything goes. It means far more listening, discussing, and self-analyzing than you may be used to. You might end up with one partner, if you're on one end of a V or an N or a W. Or you might be single. It's possible to be poly and have no partners at present. You might have fewer partners over your lifetime than someone who has many monogamous relationships in a row, like, say, Johnny Depp. Promiscuity suggests a lack of discernment. Polyamorous people may be very picky indeed. Of course, you can, if you want to, run around shagging everyone you can, as long as you accept the consequences. If you disregard the needs and feelings of people you're sleeping with, you don't get to sleep with them anymore. And in the poly world, word gets around. Acting without thought for your partners is a poor long-term relationship strategy. For those of you who imagine that polyamory is a fancy word to excuse your cheating, we have bad news for you as well. Cheating is violating trust by breaking the rules of a relationship. If taking multiple lovers does not violate trust, then it's not cheating by definition. Betrayal, not sex, is cheating's defining element. A person can move from cheating to polyamory, though it's a road fraught with peril. We'll get to that in chapter 17. You may be tempted to think that a relationship allowing multiple partners has no rules at all, but think again. Many kinds of poly relationships exist. Each has its own agreements, but all require trust, respect, and compassionate behavior. Despite the images of free love compounds that might be dancing in your head, polyamory does not necessarily mean living in a commune or an intentional community. Not all poly people live with multiple partners, or with any partners for that matter. Nor is polyamory all about couples seeking thirds. Polyamory doesn't necessarily suggest a taste for kinky sex. You can be polyamorous without mounting a trapeze in the bedroom. Many people in polyamorous relationships have straightforward tastes. Poly families spend their time balancing checkbooks, watching Netflix, doing laundry, and all the ordinary things a family does. If you're interested in polyamory because you imagine non-stop kinky orgies, you may be disappointed. Don't get us wrong. We're not knocking wild sex parties or kinky orgies. Some poly folks, Franklin, for example, are quite fond of these things. Others, like Eve, not so much. Many poly people dislike group sex, don't identify as bisexual or pansexual, and don't even own a vibrator, much less a trapeze. When the poly community first took shape, many of the most visible activists and organizers were commune-orientated pagan or New Age spiritualists. Today, polyamory attracts a much broader range of people. We've met poly folk from all walks of life, political liberals and conservatives, evangelical Christians, fundamentalist Muslims, rationalist skeptics, working single parents, college students, you name it. Downsides of polyamory. The people in the modern poly community are, by and large, groundbreakers. We are ahead of the curve in a lot of ways. Many of us embraced an unconventional approach to relationships decades before the word polyamory existed. Because of that, many of us are activists, cheerleaders, and salespeople for polyamory. That means much of what you hear about polyamory focuses on the benefits rather than the costs. We do not want to provide that one-sided view in this book. Polyamory is not nirvana. Every silver lining has a cloud around it. Only you can decide whether the benefits are worth the costs. Polyamory is complicated. When you have more than two people involved in your romantic life, things get complicated fast. Keeping many simultaneous relationships going is not for the faint of heart. Problems can occur in any relationship. Personality conflicts can arise, and all sorts of things can go wrong. In a polyamorous relationship, there are more opinions being offered, more people's feelings to get hurt, more personalities to clash, more egos to bruise. Navigating a disagreement or problem in a poly relationship requires outstanding communication skills and good problem-solving tools, which is kind of the point of this book. For some people, the fact that polyamorous relationships are more complicated than traditional ones is proof that polyamory is wrong. This argument is nonsense. Many relationships are complicated, such as those with stepchildren or between people of different religions, faiths, or cultural backgrounds. Would any reasonable person say these relationships are also wrong? At the end of the day, the best measure of a relationship isn't how complicated it is, but rather how much joy, hope, delight, support, and love it brings. Sure, polyamory can be complicated, but where's the virtue in a simple life? You will grow, whether you want to or not. A polyamorous relationship offers many opportunities for growth, some easier than others. Whether that belongs in good things or bad things depends a lot on how you feel about personal growth. You may hear some poly people sighing about AFLE or AFOG, another fucking learning experience, or another fucking opportunity for growth. Polyamory is not safe. When you give your heart to someone, it might get broken. Vulnerability can be painful. Many people try to protect themselves by placing strict controls on the form their relationships may take, or on the level to which they may grow. We have never seen this approach succeed. It merely replaces one kind of pain with another. Polyamory takes guts. It increases love and joy, but it also increases the odds that you'll be hurt. That's how it goes with romantic relationships. Polyamory means giving things up. When your lover has another lover, there will be times when you lose something, even if it's just time and attention. Any relationship needs attention in order to thrive, and no matter how close you may be to your partner's other lover, indeed, even if you and your partner share a lover, there will be times when the relationship requires one-on-one focus. It is not always possible to schedule that time so it never takes anything away from you. Polyamory changes things. We talk more about this throughout the book, but especially in chapters 14 and 17. The short version is you cannot open your heart to other people and expect your life to be unchanged. There will be disruptions, and you will not always be able to anticipate or control them. All relationships are subject to change. Even seemingly idyllic, polyamorous relationships don't necessarily last forever, any more than perfect-seeming traditional marriages do. People don't always get along. Just because someone loves your partner doesn't necessarily mean she will mesh well with you. It's easy to say, I will only date people who like my current partners, or in extreme cases, I will only date people who are romantically involved with my current partners. But in the real world, that's not always practical. You can't coerce people to like one another. And we argue that in consensual relationships. It may not even be ethical to make your love contingent on how the person you love interacts with someone else. Sometimes the best we can do is agree to be civil toward one another. Biological families, on occasion, have members who don't particularly like one another, but still have to be reasonable at family dinners. Polyamory is no different. Questions to ask yourself. We find it's not very useful to tell you what you should do. It's far more effective to pose questions when you're contemplating a course of action. We will do this throughout the book. To start with, here are some questions that can help you determine whether polyamory might be a good match for you. Have I ever felt romantic love for more than one person at the same time? Do I feel there can only be one true love or one real soulmate? How important is my desire for multiple romantic relationships? What do I want from my romantic life? Am I open to multiple sexual relationships, romantic relationships, or both? If I want more than one lover, what degree of closeness and intimacy do I expect? And what do I offer? How important is transparency to me? If I have more than one lover, am I happy with them knowing about each other? If they have lovers, am I happy about knowing about them? How do I define commitment? Is it possible for me to commit to more than one person at a time? And if so, what would those commitments look like? If I'm already in a relationship, does my desire for others come from dissatisfaction or unhappiness with my current relationship? If I were in a relationship that met my needs, would I still want multiple partners? 2. The many forms of love. Nature never repeats herself, and the possibilities of one human soul will never be found in another. Elizabeth Cady Stanton. Imagine yourself as a tree. Your roots go deep into the soil. It nourishes and supports you. They're fed by the rain, which keeps your sap flowing. Your leaves are bathed in sunlight, which provides energy. The wind brings pollen from other trees, so you can produce seeds and fruit. Maybe there's even a bird that builds a nest in your branches, raises a brood, and is gone by the fall. Each one of these things, soil, rain, sun, wind, does something different for you. None are interchangeable. Lacking one, you might wither and die, or at least fail to flourish. With too much of one, you might suffocate. This is a metaphor for your relationships. Some people, the people we might call anchor partners, but also perhaps our parents or siblings or best friends, ground us, stabilize us, support us. They are the ones we know we can always turn to. They're the soil. Others may be more variable, but no less crucial. The energizing joy-bringing sunlight, the cooling, cleansing rain, the winds that bring you new ideas and draw forth your creative force. How do you meet your own needs? Growing up in a monogamous society, we're shown only a handful of paths that love, particularly romantic love, can take. Relationships are expected to follow a specific trajectory, and we call that the relationship escalator. If a relationship doesn't follow that path, it's not real. This cookie-cutter way of looking at relationships is so ingrained that we often try to hang on to it, even when we discover polyamory. Sometimes we limit the shapes of our relationships. My boyfriend can only ever be my boyfriend because I already have a husband. Sometimes we try to follow the standard relationship trajectory with multiple people. We start by searching for two or three live-in fiddlicious partners before we even know what they want. Polyamory allows us to let go of monogamy's predefined structures. One of the amazing things polyamory offers is the freedom to negotiate relationships that work for you and your partners. The possibilities are not always obvious, even for people who have lived polyamorously for years. For example, there's often no need to break up a relationship if something or someone changes. Maybe we can keep a connection and reshape it in another way. We can build relationships that are free to develop however they naturally want to flow. It helps to recognize that love itself is malleable and ever-changing. Its intensity and nature varies, and this influences its flow, its multiple forms. Monogamy tells us that successful, real relationships all look about the same. Relationships that last a long time are called successes, without regard to misery, and those that end are called failures, without regard to happiness. Anything that is not sexually exclusive, we are told, invites chaos, anarchy, the breakdown of family. Monogamy tells us what to expect. Polyamory does not. There are no rigid templates, only nuances and shades of grey. This is both a blessing and a curse. Polyamory embraces the idea that relationships are, first and foremost, individual affairs, closely tailored to the specific needs of all the people involved. At the same time, it doesn't give us a clear path to follow. No royal road to a good relationship. Abandoning the benchmarks of monogamy can be scary. Without them, how will we know what to do? The DNA of relationships. The moment we move from cookie-cutter relationships to custom-built ones, we have to start thinking about what is and what is not possible. The vast potential in polyamorous relationships can be misleading. A relationship can be many things, but it also has built-in constraints. It's constrained by what you want, but also by what each of your partners wants, and what their partners want, and the inherent range of potential intimacy between you and your partner. Each relationship contains a range of possibilities. These possibilities are what you get to choose from. That inherent set of possibilities is the DNA of a relationship. High school science textbooks refer to DNA as a blueprint, but this is inaccurate. You use a blueprint to build a house. It maps what the house will look like, every dimension, every detail. Sure, you get control over superficial things like paint and curtains, but basically you know what you're going to get. And once the house is built, it pretty much stays the same. On the other hand, the DNA of every different creature looks pretty much the same. Its long chains of millions or billions of repeating elements are the letters that make the words that are our genes. A blueprint is a map, but DNA is more like a recipe, a set of instructions that tells cells step by step how to grow an organism. Under a microscope, a creature's DNA looks nothing like what the creature will, just as a written recipe doesn't look like a cake. So imagine then that you pick up a new seed. It contains the DNA for a whole plant, but it's not obvious what it will grow to be, big or small, annual or perennial, weedy or tenacious, or delicate and high maintenance. You have a lot of influence over how that seed grows, or whether it sprouts at all, based on the care you give it. But you're never going to get a watermelon from an onion seed. At best, you'll just get a bigger onion. And some plants seem downright determined to live. You can plant them in shade and forget to water them, and they'll keep right on growing. Relationships, like living things, but unlike buildings, grow, change, and go through cycles. Some offer fruit, others flowers, and there might even be times when it seems like they're providing nothing at all. They have seasons, and they can die. So when we say relationships have DNA, not blueprints, what we mean is that relationships, unlike houses, are alive. Society gives us a blueprint for what relationships are supposed to look like. One man, one woman, 2.4 kids, a yard, PTA meetings, apple pie. We propose relationships that don't fit a blueprint, relationships that are as individual as the people in them. Relationships that don't need to be mass-produced to factory specifications. We can grow them to meet our needs. That's why we like to compare the work that goes into growing your relationship to the work of tending a garden. Your garden will thrive, or not, based on the time and skill that goes into watering, weeding, fertilizing, and selecting and placing your plants. Your relationship efforts. As well as on the health of your soil and exposure to sun. Your own self-work. But the things in your garden have lives of their own. Things they can and cannot become. Things they can and cannot give. Things they need. And things that don't affect them at all. And sometimes they may not turn out the way you expect. Relationships will seek their own true expressions, no matter how much you try to contain or control them. Just as you can't look at a strange seed and tell what it will be, you can't start a new relationship and tell how it will grow. If you insist on planting the next seed you find in the shade no matter what, or if you insist on forcing a new relationship to fit a certain mold, and this approach works, coincidence has entered the picture. Remain mindful of the needs of things you choose to grow in your garden. Make sure there's space for things that you want to add to it, and that you have the time and energy to care for them. Remember, too, that the purpose of the garden is ultimately to nourish the gardener. If you filled your garden with potatoes and you want some vitamins, it's okay to make some room for kale and carrots. If the big shady oak tree that you've loved for decades is shading your entire garden so that nothing else can take root, you might need to gently prune some of the tree's branches to let the light in. And if something you're growing is no longer nurturing you, if it's taking up time and resources from you and the other things in your garden and not giving anything back, then it does not have an inherent right to be in your garden. And if it turns out to be toxic to you or those you care about, it's okay to pull it out. Being flexible. A core value that we promote in this book is the idea of flexibility. Polyamorous relationships come in an enormous variety of flavors, so they encourage flexibility in ways that most relationship structures don't. Flexibility does not come naturally. It can be difficult to cast off a lifetime of ideas about how relationships should look, because we're steeped in a limited number of relationship models. It's sometimes overwhelming to try and understand just how many ways relationships can work. We mentioned several different personal approaches to polyamory in Chapter 1. These different approaches result, as you might imagine, in very different kinds of relationships. Since polyamory invites us to build relationships tailored to the needs of everyone involved, it demands that we think carefully about our relationships and craft them accordingly. Poly relationships span the gaunt from structured, living-together families to loose networks of people who don't cohabit, with all sorts of configurations in between. These relationship forms reflect their members' varying needs for structure or flexibility, for cohesion or independence, for touch and contact or private space. If you're making a garden, you can buy the seeds that will grow into the plants you want. With poly relationships, it's tempting to plan out how you want your life to look and then search for people who fit the plan. But unlike seeds, people don't come from a store neatly labeled. You can't look at a person and predict what a relationship will grow into. Relationships have a tricky way of zigging when you expect them to zag. Sure, it's important to communicate what you want in your relationship up front, but it's also important to remember you're not ordering a relationship from a catalogue. Leave space for them to grow. Don't freak out if they grow in ways that you didn't expect. Approaches to relationships. Hidden within different types of polyamorous relationship structures are some very different ideas about relationships in general. About autonomy, community, entwinement, romance, sex and partnership. Poly people tend to speak of these different approaches as existing on two axes. One axis runs from free agent to community-orientated. The other runs from solo to entwined. They sound alike, but they're not. Some poly people consider themselves free agents. That is, they value personal autonomy highly. They place importance on the ability to make their own decisions and present to the world as able to act without requiring permission from others. The model of free agent poly can be difficult at first to understand. It's easy to make the mistake of thinking that free agents don't commit or don't consider the needs of their lovers, aka metamors, or don't care about the community. This isn't true. In reality, the free agent model places responsibility for decision-making and for bearing the consequences on each person individually. For instance, your partners may tell you how they feel about your desire to start a new relationship. You may listen to them and decide not to go ahead with it based on what they say, but the choice is yours, not theirs. You evaluate their concerns, and then you choose. The extreme end of free agency is called relationship anarchy, or RA. It's an approach that rejects the need to categorize and rank relationships at all. Joe is my friend, Mark is my boyfriend, Kayser is my husband. Or to create rules or define roles. In particular, RA does not privilege sexual or romantic relationships over others. On the opposite end of the scale is what some call a community-orientated model of polyamory. People who adopt this model focus on the interconnectedness of their relationships and their community. You might think the difference between free agents and community-orientated polyamorous is about independent action versus consensus. But that's overly simplistic. Free agents, and particularly relationship anarchists, emphasize the need for negotiation, and mutual benefit over the idea that there's a normal or right way to have relationships. It might be more accurate to say the difference is in the priority that's given to different factors in the decision-making process. Community-minded polyfolks tend to prioritize the impact of a decision on the entire group over the needs of the individual in the group. This doesn't necessarily mean that community-orientated people must have their partner's permission to start a relationship. However, decisions are made with an eye towards how, say, a potential new partner might fit with the others. The other axis, from solo polyamory to entwined poly, looks similar on the surface but reflects a completely different underlying set of values. People who embrace solo poly present to the world as single at first glance. They are off the relationship escalator, the assumption that relationships follow a defined course. You meet, fall in love, move in together, share property, have children, and grow old together. Solo poly folks may not want to live with any partner, or if they do, they may not choose to share finances or property. By contrast, other people prefer relationships that are more entwined, practically, financially, or both. These people value sharing living space, spending time in close proximity, sharing financial or household obligations, and so on. They may see themselves as part of a unit, a single family that shares responsibilities together and approaches life together. So the scale from free agency to community then is about decision-making within a relationship, whereas the scale from solo poly to entwined poly is about the form that relationships will take. Few are on the extreme ends of these scales. It's more common to encounter people in the middle, for instance, who like living with a lover but still prefer to think of themselves as autonomous individuals, or people who pay close attention to how well potential partners fit together but still make relationship decisions themselves. Polyamorous relationship structures. On the surface, the simplest seeming poly configuration is a triad, three people who are all deeply involved with one another, or a V, one person called the pivot, with two romantic partners. Triads and Vs may or may not live together and may or may not be open to new partners. In many, perhaps most cases, triads start out as Vs, and then a companionship or a romance develops between the two partners of the pivot person. A quad is a poly relationship involving four people. Quads often, but not always, form when two couples come together. They might also form when one person has three partners, when members of a couple each start an independent relationship with a new person who's single, or even when four previously unpartnered people start a relationship. The connections within a quad can vary all over the map. There are quads in which every member is intimate with all three others. There are Ns, which often form when two couples come together, with only one intimate relationship between the couples, and asterisks, where one person has three or more partners not involved with each other. Like triads, quads may or may not live together, and they may or may not be open to new romantic connections. An interesting pattern we have both seen with quads that form from two couples is that after a time the two couples may swap partners and the quad breaks up. Sometimes people in a couple know they have problems. Rather than deal with them directly, they try to start new relationships in a structure that is safe. If, for example, the wife in one couple dates the husband in another, while his wife dates the husband from the first couple, they may believe that nobody will ever feel left out, and the other couple will have no reason to threaten them, because, presumably, the other couple wants to preserve their present setup too. In practice, the new relationships can highlight problems and unmet needs in both couples, with the result being a repartnering and breakup. Larger configurations exist as well. Quite common are open networks, where each person may have several partners, some of whom may be involved with another and others not. Relationship networks tend to be loosely structured and often don't have a defining hierarchy. Members of some poly groups consider themselves married to one another. Plural marriages is not legally recognized in Western countries, but some people in poly relationships call each other husbands or wives, hold commitment ceremonies, exchange rings, or do other things that symbolize their serious relationship with each other. Franklin, for example, has exchanged rings with two of his current partners. Other polyamorous groupings don't consider themselves a single family. Some groups have internal hierarchy in which certain relationships, often between a married couple, take precedence over others. This version of poly is often called primary, secondary, and we talk about it in Chapter 11. Other groups have no assumption of a power hierarchy. That does not necessarily suggest a person is treated the same as every other, but that no one relationship always takes precedence. Each is allowed to seek its own level, and new relationships are not necessarily expected to be subordinate. We talk about these in Chapter 13. Different groups have different expectations about agreements and rules. Some polyamorous relationships are rules-based, with detailed prescriptions on behavior, including sexual behavior, between different partners. Others don't impose rules on their members. Some include a veto clause, which permits one person to tell another to end a relationship with a third person. Though, as we discuss in Chapter 12, these agreements can be difficult to implement and dangerous to use. Other relationships have no veto provisions, preferring negotiation and discussion instead. We discuss some common poly structures with their pitfalls and benefits in Part 3. Confronting assumptions about sex. Polyamory makes a few assumptions about sexual connections. In monogamy, a romantic partner and a sexual partner are almost by definition the same person. Emotional intimacy and physical intimacy are so tightly entwined that some self-help books speak of emotional infidelity and encourage married couples not to permit each other to become too close to their friends. Advice columnists and television personalities will speak gravely of the dangers that emotional affairs pose to monogamous marriage and ask, is emotional infidelity worse than sexual infidelity? Monogamy can leave surprisingly little room for close friendships, much less non-sexual romances. Your intimate friend and your sexual partner are presumed to be one and the same. This creates problems when the couple are no longer sexually attracted to one another or have mismatched libidos. It also creates problems for people who identify as asexual.